You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Democratic National Convention wrapped up last night. We'll look back at how the week's virtual format worked out and what Joe Biden's acceptance speech could mean for the rest of the campaign. First, Wisconsin has held two elections amid the public health emergency caused by COVID-19. Voting absentee through the mail has increased. That trend is predicted to hold up for November's presidential election. Recent polling shows a partisan divide between Wisconsinites who plan to vote by mail and those who plan to vote at their polling place. Our next guest has been exploring the impacts that partisan voting methods could have on our elections. Craig Gilbert is Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's covered presidential elections and Wisconsin's role as a swing state. Greg, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's nice to be with you.
Let's start with those polls. What are they telling us about who plans to vote by mail versus going in to vote in person?
So there's been lots of polling both in Wisconsin and nationally that points to the fact that Democrats are much more likely than Republicans to say they intend to vote by mail, and Republicans are much more likely than Democrats to say they plan to vote in person on Election Day at the polls. One way this translates is that we saw in a recent Wisconsin poll done by the Marquette Law School that among the people who plan to vote by mail, Joe Biden was leading Donald Trump by 67 points. But among the people planning to vote in person on Election Day, Donald Trump was leading Joe Biden by 41 points. So you can imagine how odd it is and a little unsettling to think about, two very different blocks of voters, using very different methods to vote when there are all sorts of things that could happen between now and Election Day that could affect one or both of those methods of voting.
Let's get into that in just a bit. Let's talk about why. Why do we have such a partisan divide in how we're going to vote?
So this is clearly, responsive to the debate, the partisan debate we've been having. Some of this is sort of longstanding differences between the parties and also, obviously, President Trump's rhetoric about mail voting, very critical. He talks about fraud. He questions the legitimacy. He said a lot of negative things about voting by mail, which may be, leading his supporters to say, hey, I'm not going to vote that way. Meanwhile, you've got Democrats who tend to register higher levels of concern about the pandemic, which would make them more anxious about voting in person and be more likely to see mail as an alternative. So all those things are kind of playing into it right now.
Some states already use mail-in ballots. This issue has made it already to the Democratic National Convention. Here's Mayor Jenny Wilson from Utah's Salt Lake County talking about mail-in voting during Tuesday's roll call of the Democratic National Convention.
Here in Utah, we've had mail-in voting for years. If you're registered to vote, you automatically get sent a ballot. It's fast, it's reliable, and it's easy for everyone to participate. In 2016, we had turnout well over 80%, and this year we're expecting even higher. That's why Democrats and Republicans here in Utah agree. Mail-in voting strengthens our democracy.
A Democrat there, but one in a Republican state that's embraced mail-in voting. And you write, Craig, that some Republicans around the country, I think here in Wisconsin as well, are a little worried about President Trump's opposition to mail-in voting, maybe suppressing Republican turnout by mail.
Yeah, Republican voters are getting a lot of mixed signals. I mean, the Republican Party of Wisconsin is promoting absentee voting by mail. I mean, they've always had programs for that. And they are going to be sending ballot applications to some of their voters. They've already started doing that. But meanwhile, you've got President Trump saying negative things. And sometimes he just issues blanket statements about voting by mail. And sometimes he makes this distinction between these kind of institutionalized, 95% mail-in vote systems like you have in Utah and in the Pacific Northwest, and states like Wisconsin, where you can vote absentee by mail, and you still have to, go through a lot of steps to do that. But people are getting mixed messages, particularly in the Republican Party, about voting by mail. And so some Republicans are kind of worried that, if it that depresses the use of the mail ballot among their side, it sort of removes one way of getting people's votes in. And if people in the pandemic are scared about going to the polls and they don't have the option of mail, then they're not going to end up voting.
Talking to Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a partisan divide over how people say they are planning to vote in November. Democrats more by mail, Republicans more in person, and what impact that could have on the election. All right, Craig, let's talk about some scenarios where something bad happens election-wise and it hurts one side or the other. What are some of the possibilities out there?
Well, so one possibility is that, you know, there are problems with the post office, and we've been reading about potential problems with the post office, and this is making Democrats very nervous. So if you have Democrats disproportionately trying to vote through the mail, and the mail, you know, there's a slowdown, and, you know, they don't get their ballot applications in time. They don't get their ballots in time after sending away for their ballots. They don't get their ballots back in time. So that's a very bad scenario for Democrats. There's also, you know, traditionally a slightly higher rejection rate for mail ballots. There's a lot of things that can go wrong. I mean, in Wisconsin, you have to have a witness for your signature. You know, they have to provide their signature. There's a lot of little boxes you have to check. And if you don't do them all, you know, that can result in an invalid ballot. On the other side, the kind of, I guess, one of the nightmare scenarios for Republicans is that, you know, Republicans overwhelmingly eschew the mail ballot and decide to vote in person at the polls. And then we have like a big wave of COVID cases in the weeks before the election. And suddenly, you know, voting at the polls is really scary, and it depresses the turnout rate for in-person election day voting. And that might have a depressive effect on the Republican vote. So it's a weird situation, because up until now in Wisconsin, you haven't had this anything like this partisan dichotomy, because not very many people voted by mail, and there was the option to vote absentee in person in the weeks leading up to the election, and Democrats have made use of that more than Republicans, but it didn't have the implications that this situation we're in now has.
Now, let's suppose everything goes just peachy, but Election Day is going to look maybe kind of different than we're used to. What could be the shape as votes come in and get tallied in different orders than they used to?
So we don't know what election night is going to look like for a variety of reasons. So one possibility is that the it takes longer to count the mail votes than the in-person votes. You do have to go through extra steps. I mean, the votes end up getting fed into the same machines, but you have to open an envelope. If you're counting these ballots, you have to verify what's on the outside of the envelope in terms of signatures. So one issue is whether right now under state law, election clerks are not allowed to start processing, you know, these mail ballots to see whether they're valid or not, not counting them, but just start processing them before Election Day. So there's an effort, and this is a subject of litigation, to allow clerks to start processing the ballots, again, not counting them, but processing them before Election Day, to avoid these scenarios of counts taking a long time. Another scenario is for just, you know, mail ballots arriving after Election Day. And again, under state law, they have to arrive by Election Day. But we saw in the April election, a judge said, hey, wait a minute, that's not enough time. And he allowed ballots to be counted after Election Day, which resulted in a count that took place almost a week after Election Day. So a lot of these things are being fought over in court, in federal court right now. So we don't have the answer to that question, because we don't know exactly how the system is going to work. We don't know what the rules are going to be. So we don't know whether we're going to have a result in Wisconsin on election night, at midnight, at 3 o'clock in the morning, or in the days that follow.
Craig Gilbert is with us, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's here with us to talk about the partisan divide over the way we vote absentee or at a polling place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you plan to vote in November? Have you embraced voting by mail in this weird year? Are you concerned about the Postal Service's ability to support absentee voting? Do you feel safe going into a polling place? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Craig Gilbert. He covers national politics at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we're talking about the polling and election data that shows a partisan divide in the ways we cast our ballots in person versus mail. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you changed or thought about changing how you vote during the pandemic? What challenges have you faced in maybe Wisconsin's primaries this year? How do you feel about having more access to mail-in voting? Call 800-642-1234. Craig, before we go to our callers, another thing on the whole calling it on election night. Partly it'll be delayed maybe by mail-in ballots, but also, as I understand it, when AP calls elections, they're relying on exit poll data, where they're asking people, who'd you just vote for? If a non-representative sample is doing it by mail instead, that's going to make that a lot harder to do, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to use exit polls the way we've been using them when most of the votes are coming in by mail. So, you know, you'd really have to be relying more on kind of traditional polling. And so that's a big question mark. And the other thing that we haven't talked about fully is just the implications of a count that takes several days. Scholars who've studied this have labeled something called the blue shift, where because if Democrats are more likely to vote by mail and those votes take longer to count, the results could become sort of be better and better for the Democrats the more ballots are counted. And the question is how that looks to Republicans if they're winning on election night, but after three or four more days, they're losing, and whether that sort of feeds into a debate, a partisan debate about the legitimacy of the election or not.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Joanne is with us in Stoughton. Joanne, hi.
Hi. My thoughts on the whole absentee mail-in versus whatever. My plan is I already am getting my absentee ballot, and I am going to actually take it to my city drop-off. And then I don't even have to worry whether the post office is going to delay anything. So I'm not sure why people aren't discussing that even a little bit more.
Joanne, thanks a lot for the call. Craig, talk about that in-person absentee voting. You touched on that briefly earlier.
Yeah, this is actually starting to get a lot of discussion. So when I mentioned in-person absentee voting earlier, I was talking about people who actually literally go into City Hall in the 2 weeks before the election and vote early. But here we have a situation where voters can, you know, send away for their ballot, they get their ballot, they fill it out, and then instead of mailing it back, if they really want to be certain ahead of the election, they can deliver it in person to their city. And they don't have to worry about whether, you know, it got there through the mail or not, or whether it's going to get there on time. And then it's held at City Hall or by the election clerks until it's counted on election night. So that is, I've heard a number of people talk about this. I mean, it's one way of voting, I think, that gives people some comfort because it eliminates kind of one of the intermediate steps.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Kaylee now in Brookfield. Kaylee, hi.
Hello.
What'd you want to bring up?
Yeah, so my question was, I guess, kind of piggybacking off of the previous caller's question or statement of bringing her ballot to the clerk treasurer's office. And I have taken advantage of the mail-in voting for a couple of years now, but I wanted to make sure that my ballot was counted. Is there a way that I can check that, or where would I go to find out to make sure that my vote counted?
Well, go ahead, Craig. Yeah, I'm not sure I can give you a great answer to that. I mean, I think, you know, obviously, if you're voting the traditional way and going in on election day or ahead of election day and using a machine, you know, you can feed your ballot into that machine or depending on what kind of voting system is used. And you have that certainty and peace of mind. I think if you're delivering your ballot in person, then that gives you some certainty. If you're mailing your ballot in, I know that there are going to be you know, there's coding with these ballots this time, barcodes. And so that does give, that does provide an ability to track ballots. But I don't know whether, you know, voters have the ability, you know, individually to, you know, kind of verify whether their ballot has been counted or not.
Yeah, I think you can go online after it has been counted, but that doesn't really help because that's after Election Day. You can't go back and fix anything then. Yeah, interesting. Thank you for that question. And we're going to we'll be doing a segment or two on Central Time between now and Election Day with a lot of the nuts and bolts of the various ways of voting. Thanks for that call. Tom joins us next in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to ask about, Tom?
Yes, it appears to me that Wisconsin's absentee voting system is has got some voter suppression in it. You have to have a signature from a witness. Some people live alone and they can't get, you know, they have to go find somebody to sign it for them. Also, it requires a photo ID. Now, some people can't don't have cell phones and can't upload it to their computer and upload it to the clerk. Or they have to go get a passport photo to staple to their application. And what are they going to do with a photo ID if nobody will see me when my vote is cast?
Interesting. Photo ID for voting by mail, Craig.
Yeah, so these are all issues that are actually being debated in court. I mean, Wisconsin does have a voter ID law that was implemented by Republicans under the previous governor, and this is part of that law. And yes, you do have to get a witness to your vote if you're voting absentee. And yes, some people have posed the question, well, you know, in the pandemic, that's not such an easy thing to do. So there are people, you know, are litigating this in court about whether there could be some relief from that requirement. There are contingencies in the law for people who have particular issues for them to get waivers of some of these mandates. But there's sort of fights over how liberally those waivers should be granted. I mean, everything you can imagine about this system is not only sort of a subject of partisan debate, but it's a subject of litigation. And so, again, it's the landscape is shifting, and we don't know exactly what it's going to look like right now, what it's going to look like in November.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a partisan divide over mail-in versus in-person voting. Back to your calls. Jerry is with us in Milwaukee. Jerry, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Jerry?
Well, the fact is, I will, for the second time in my life, will do mail-in voting. I have voted all my life in person, but because of the situation with the virus, I will not do that. I, in fact, am also a poll worker, and I've been a poll worker for about 5 years, and I will not be doing that either. And the simple reason is, I don't want to risk my health for voting. Although I think it's very important, I will not do that.
Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. That is an issue. Jerry's role as a poll worker there, that has been a big factor in Wisconsin this year, Craig.
Yeah, there was obviously a big shortage in some places of poll workers in April. There's sort of the issue of the use of the National Guard to fill that gap. There's a call out for volunteers, but, you know, poll workers have traditionally been, you know, people who are older. And in some cases, these are people that have a higher risk. And so this is a big concern when it comes to making the in-person, the traditional, you know, Election Day voting system work. You know, the caller who said they'd never voted by mail before, I mean, traditionally, this represented about 5 or 6% of the Wisconsin vote, absentee mail ballots. I mean, hardly anybody did it. But in the April election, it was about almost 2/3 of the vote. So, you know, we're looking at just sort of a radical transformation in how people vote on the fly, particularly April on the fly. I mean, the one thing, you know, kind of, you know, ray of hope here is that at least in November, people have more time to prepare for this, but they're also going to have to prepare for, you know, a much higher volume of voting in a presidential election, which is going to stress the system.
Thanks for that call, Jerry. Willem joins us in Colfax now for our last minute or so. Willem, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment about the president's statements about universal mail-in voting will be fraudulent. There's no such thing as universal mail-in voting. We don't have a federal vote. Each state determines how they vote, whether they vote by mail. Some states don't allow it. Some states have done it for decades. So he says something like this, and then it gets picked up all the time, universal mail-in balloting. There's no such thing as universal mail-in balloting.
Thanks for the call, and it is a patchwork around the country, Craig.
Yeah, and so some states, you know, overwhelmingly use mail-in voting, like Utah. One interesting wrinkle is that, you know, if you look at the battleground states and the states that are overwhelmingly going to determine the Electoral College winner, I mean, basically none of them use universal mail-in voting. I mean, they're typically states like Wisconsin where they provide for the possibility of no excuse absentee voting through the mail, but it typically hasn't been the backbone of the system. So the kinds of voting systems that President Trump has been complaining about the most are by and large voting systems that are used in states that aren't really contested in this presidential election.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Anytime.
Craig Gilbert is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us for a look at the partisan divide over voting by mail versus voting in person. Coming up, we'll look back at this week's Democratic National Convention, including the mostly virtual format and Joe Biden's acceptance speech. You can share your thoughts right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7:30 on The Morning Show, an expert on homelessness in Wisconsin tells us how COVID-19 and an economic downturn are putting more people at risk of losing their housing and what kind of help is available. That's Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Democratic National Convention wrapped up last night. It was a mostly virtual week that combined live speeches, pre-recorded talks, and a fireworks display. That came after Joe Biden's speech last night accepting the party's nomination. Throughout his address, Biden drew a distinction between himself and President Trump as a matter of light and darkness.
Here and now, I give you my word. If you entrust me with the presidency, I will draw on the best of us, not the worst. I'll be an ally of the light, not the darkness. It's time for us, for we the people, to come together.
Republicans will respond at their convention next week, and we'll cover that here as well. Right now, we're looking back at the DNC with Eric Heberlig. He's a professor of political science and public administration at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. He's co-author of the book American Cities and the Politics of Party Conventions. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's an unusual year, obviously, for conventions. What are your thoughts on how the virtual format worked out for Democrats this week?
Moving to the virtual format was something obviously that had never happened before, so none of us were too sure of what to expect. And I think the Democrats did as well as they hoped to, probably better. There are all kinds of logistical hazards that can come with these type of virtual technologies, and things seem to go very smoothly. I thought they did a number of things to try to take advantage of the virtual technologies. That worked really well. Some other ideas they had that were worth trying that I think didn't work as well. I think the things that worked really well, the roll call of the states, which is typically part of the convention where each state talks about the number of votes it's giving to each of the candidates, accompanies that with a long-winded speech about the merits of their state. And it's usually pretty tedious, and the networks cut away from it. This time I was watching, and they cut away from it, and I flipped to another station to find it because it was fascinating to see the delegates with the scenery of their home state behind them, and they kept it to 30 seconds, and it was really interesting. Other things they tried, like having Joe Biden coordinate little talk sessions with various people, I thought that was a good effort. I don't think that worked as well. But that trial and error is, you know, what you have to expect.
You've written about party conventions before, as we mentioned. What are parties trying to accomplish in a convention, and did the Democrats meet those guidelines?
So they're trying to do two things. One, they're trying to unify and mobilize their party supporters. And the second is they're using the convention as the opening of the general election campaign to persuade swing voters to come to their side. I think the Democrats were united this time out of their intense opposition to Donald Trump. I think the virtual convention helped them control the message that might have been more diverse or contentious. If it were on the floor of the convention, we saw those splits between the Sanders and Clinton factions in 2016. I think they did well in communicating to persuadable voters, although I'm not sure a whole lot of them were watching, in that they had Republicans and former Republicans vouch for Joe Biden. They did a good job of conveying Biden's personality, his background, his empathy for the public, and they did a good job of leading up to the high point of his acceptance speech on Thursday night, which seemed to go quite well.
We are talking about the Democratic National Convention this week with Eric Heberlig from the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch some or all? What did you think? How did it work? Did you hear the messages from Democrats that you wanted to hear or were worried about hearing? 800-642-1234 is the number. Eric, you are in a similar camp with us here in Wisconsin. You expected to get a big show, a big convention, Democrats here, Republicans there, and it didn't happen. Do you think that, you know, the parties have to show some diplomacy to the places that might feel a little slighted by not getting what they were hoping for?
Yeah, Milwaukee and Charlotte got ripped off this year. There's no way to put lipstick on it. And I think this is going to have some important repercussions for 2024. The way cities get the honor of hosting these conventions is that the national parties ask them to bid for it, and the cities basically commit themselves to put a lot of fundraising effort and planning effort into hosting these big events. And the trade-off for that is that the city hopes to get a lot of direct spending from delegates and the media showing up and buying hotel rooms and eating catered food and renting taxis. And the cities also want a lot of public relations benefits out of it, as the national and international media show up and do stories on their cities and use their city skyline as the backdrop for the visuals of the conventions. And Charlotte and Milwaukee didn't get that this year. They didn't get any direct spending. They didn't get any of the public relations benefits.
Getting back to the messaging now for Democrats, former Vice President Biden and many others focused on their ideas, their for democracy, their vision for America, and their contrast with President Trump. Getting listen to Biden again, he mentioned that while talking about President Trump's response to a white supremacist attack in Charlottesville in 2017 that killed one person. Here's a listen to Joe Biden responding to the president's response.
It was a wake-up call for us as a country. And for me, a call to action. At that moment, I knew I'd have to run. Because my father taught us that silence was complicity. And I can never remain silent or complicit. At the time, I said we're in the battle for the soul of this nation. And we are.
Can you talk about the contrast Biden and other Democrats made with the president and making the case that there's a lot at stake here?
Absolutely. That was a theme of the week. His performance, particularly on the COVID crisis, his performance on racial reconciliation and the Floyd protests. As Biden put it in his speech, his ending emphasis, the difference between love and hope and light and the contrast with the Republicans and Barack Obama's speech, arguing that democracy was at stake. So the Democrats put in very stark terms what they think is at stake in this election in order to motivate people to come out and vote.
Another issue that came up, at least from one Wisconsin speaker at the event, was healthcare related to COVID-19, but not just about that. The U.S. Supreme Court is going to hear a challenge to the Affordable Care Act, I believe, a week after Election Day. Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin talked about the issue. Here's a listen to her and some of her personal story.
When I was 9 years old, I got sick, really sick. I was hospitalized, but since my grandparents were the ones raising me and our family's health plan didn't cover grandkids, they were forced to pay out of pocket for my 3-month hospital stay. I got better, but the insurance companies didn't.
Now, one read on Democratic success in 2018, Eric, is that they focused on this healthcare issue. Did you hear as much about that, apart from Senator Baldwin there at this convention?
No, their policy emphases were kind of scattered. And they had different policy emphases every night. But it led to a bit of incoherence thematically because they kind of jumped from one thing to the next. I guess the upside of that is that Democrats tend to have a broad variety of policy interests across their coalition. So everybody could hear their issue discussed on a different night, and likewise persuadable voters hopefully heard something about what they were interested in hearing across the convention.
We're talking to Eric Heberlig, professor of political science and public administration at UNC Charlotte, about this week's Democratic National Convention. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think of what you watched, if you watched, from the convention this week? How did you watch? Did you watch on live TV, live streaming, or did you watch the highlights the next morning? How do you think this format worked out? Did you hear issues talked about that you wanted to? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Eric Heberlig, professor of political science and public administration at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, looking at the Democratic National Convention over the course of the week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch some or all? What did you think? What stood out to you in terms of messaging, in terms of this virtual format? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was going to ask your guest real quickly if he thought the virtual convention assisted in the Democratic Party presenting Joe Biden with multiple facets, such that it seems more confusing. They had Republicans who seemed to be saying he was a moderate, yet Bernie Sanders says he's going to be the most progressive president since FDR. An example would be, are they for or against Medicare for all? They didn't touch on China, for example. Is Joe going to address the situation with his son Hunter, or are they just going to ignore it? I didn't find that the convention clarified the situation of what they're running on, and I was hoping your guest could comment on whether he thought Joe Biden is more clarified now than he was before or after the convention.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Of course, Hunter Biden on stage, or the equivalent of a stage for part of that. But the Trump campaign posting ads over the last couple of days saying Biden has sold out fully to the far left of the party. What do you think, Eric, about how Joe Biden has tried to thread the needle here?
Yeah, they clearly emphasized Biden's personal story, his biography, to contrast what they see as his decency versus Trump's character, and went lighter on spelling out policy details. Now, they did talk about a number of policy areas pretty much in the earlier hour, so it may not have been covered in the primetime elements that many people watched. But even so, they spent very little on foreign policy, which the caller mentioned. To some extent, that surprised me. I thought we'd hear more about Trump's unwillingness to stand up to Vladimir Putin. We did hear that a little bit, but I thought we'd hear a lot more of it. It was certainly an emphasis on the COVID crisis and racial justice as the policy focus in the convention.
Thanks a lot for the call, Charlie. We'll go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Peter is with us in Stoughton. Peter, hi.
Good afternoon. One thing that I was surprised to be enjoying was the lack of a crowd. The speakers could get on with things without having to worry about a whole bunch of people getting up and down and clapping and this and that. So they were able to provide a lot more content, or so I thought. And I was surprised at this. But not having a crowd around was a positive thing for me.
Interesting take, Peter, because a lot of times, Eric, people are saying, oh, the lack of the crowd, you don't have that sense of enthusiasm. But you get maybe more content while you're not waiting for the applause to die down.
Yeah, I definitely thought the speeches were much more efficient. they went faster when you don't have to wait around for people to stop clapping. I also thought particularly Michelle Obama adapted her speech well. It felt to me like I was sitting across the kitchen table from her and she was having a conversation with me. And I thought that was very effective. I thought other speeches, particularly from politicians who were kind of continuing to give a big speech that they would have given to an arena full of people, I thought those worked less well in this new setting.
Thanks a lot for the call. Samantha joins us now in Whitehall. Samantha, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The little bit that I had seen of the convention, it just seemed like they were mostly trying to bash in Trump and how to get him out, but I was kind of confused because they didn't really give a clear indication of how they would be, wanting to get him out and why, because, that's the thing I was wondering is why, because that's just what it seemed like to me, that they really didn't give very clear indication on what they were what their goal was on getting him out, I guess.
Samantha, thanks for the call. Samantha's not alone. Pete on Facebook wrote the convention. He says it's a sales pitch. Sad they talked more about Trump than what they were going to actually do and how to pay for it. What do you make of that balance between attacking the incumbent and laying out their own vision for governing?
That's a balance they need to strike. They need to do both. And the challenge here, unlike 2016, there wasn't an incumbent. This time there is. Anytime there's an incumbent on the ballot, what the out party has to do is convince people that, first of all, there needs to be a change. If people aren't convinced there needs to be a change, then it doesn't matter what the party promises to do differently. Part of what I think they were trying to do was have other people lay out the case against Trump to try to free up Kamala Harris and Joe Biden to talk more about their biographies. And what their plans were. I think we got the biography, the character-heavy presentations on both Harris and Biden, and got less emphasis on policy. And I'm sure they thought it through, but as your caller indicated, that may be a risk. I thought one of the criticisms of Hillary Clinton in 2016 was that her campaign was too focused on Trump's liabilities and not focused enough on what she would do if she were president. And so I was kind of surprised, too, that the Democrats didn't spend more time talking about their vision for the future rather than just telling us what many of us already know about Trump's character.
Thanks for that call. We are talking about the Democratic National Convention this week with Eric Heberlig from the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. Democrats have made a lot of the president's comment about people dying of COVID, saying it is what it is in an interview. Some people saying they've tried to make that a catchphrase and hang the president's words on him. And that might account for the character focus you're talking about with Joe Biden and kind of the personal side of him showing him grieving and connecting with people and trying to raise that as part of the character contrast. Do you see that as a strategy? If so, do you see it as a good strategy?
Absolutely. One thing you're trying to do in any political messaging is draw a contrast between the candidates to give people a clear choice and hope they will choose the side of the choice that you're promoting. So Trump's perhaps callous response there gives the Democrats a clear ability to contrast Joe Biden's experience with death in his family, the compassion he has that many people attested to throughout the convention, they want people to see that, hey, Joe Biden understands real people like you, understands pain, can help us get through this crisis in ways that Trump has not.
Let's go back to our callers. Polly is with us in Wauwatosa. Polly, hi.
Hi. I was so glad I stayed up way beyond my bedtime and to hear the speech that came right from Joe Biden's heart through the whole thing. Nothing written by someone else, you know, written to draw applause every 2 minutes here and there. It was Joe Biden from the heart, and to have a president with heart is something we can all use after the last 4 years.
Polly, thanks a lot for the call. I don't know if there were speechwriters involved or not, Eric, but that sense anyway that came through, Polly says that it came from the heart.
I'm sure there were speechwriters involved, but, you know, their job is to channel and put in the most compelling way the ideas of the candidate. And we saw, you know, very effectively weave into his speech his personal story. He talked about the lessons from his father. He talked about his experiences in losing his wife and daughter. He talked about the death of his son, Beau, and how those are important motivations. Again, part of what he was doing was telling us about his character and how that will serve us if he is elected, and how those experiences motivate him into public service and the type of issues he thinks are important.
Thanks a lot for that call. In our last minute, Eric, can you preview for us? We've been talking about the Democratic convention that mostly wasn't here in Milwaukee. What are you expecting from the Republican convention that mostly won't be in your city of Charlotte?
I think we've seen how Trump likes to communicate over the last 5 years. So I think we'll see more of the same. I think the Republicans will have observed what the Democrats did in their virtual convention. And we'll have the ability to take things that work and try to build on it and not do the things that they don't think will work. I think we'll see some of the real people giving their testimonials. I thought that worked really well about the Democratic National Convention. So I think we'll see more of that from the Republicans.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Eric Heberlig is a professor of political science and public administration at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. He's co-author of the book American Cities and the Politics of Party Conventions. He joined us for a look at the Democratic National Convention this week. Next week, we'll be covering the Republican National Convention. Listen in on Monday and Friday for those conversations. You can weigh in with your thoughts on what you've seen this last week, what you're watching for next week over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on Central Time, in addition to that preview of the Republican convention and where it fits into the election campaign, a new report breaks down American attitudes toward the media. There's a lot of mistrust, but it may depend on which media you're talking about and who you're talking to about it. We'll dig into the research and you can share your thoughts. And a Milwaukee writer takes us on a tour of local houses with fallout shelters. That's Monday on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 8, the pandemic has made treatment difficult for people with cancer. Healy and her guests look at physical and mental health care for cancer patients during the COVID-19 era. That's Monday at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then our guest for Food Friday gives us some license and some delicious ideas to put off other tasks and procrastinate. And we've got some baking recipes from our guest. You can find three of them over at wpr.org/Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.